Today's Tay Show will be on case 96 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record. Heikigan, case 96 is entitled Joshu's Three Turning Words. Main subject, Joshu said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. Secho's verse, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. The divine light illuminates heaven and earth. Had Shinko not stood in the snow, many deceptions, many pretenses. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to visit Shiko and found the warning notice on the board, but everywhere the gentle breezes. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how the monk Hosada broke down the oven of sacrifice whose gods had so long bound himself. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning and sitting so well, so still, and online and here in person. I think this is a milestone since COVID. We actually have as many people here in person as online. So that's really wonderful. That's a real milestone. I'm so glad. And if you're here, that's wonderful. It's nice to sit with other people. But if you're online, I'm so glad you're practicing. Some of you are far away, and this has made practice together possible. So this is really a wonderful koan, right? As you know, the world of Buddhism is filled with terracotta images of the Buddha, and it's also filled with bronze images and gold leaf images of the Buddha and cast iron and wooden images of Buddha. And Joshu says, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. Right, so that's the koan. So, I am teaching an environmental literature class. And this is the second time I've taught this class. I taught the class about 3 years ago. And the first time I taught it, I started with H.D. Thoreau. If you know anything about nature writing, Thoreau is like the most important person. And he's somebody I have read and reread all my life. So, there are passages in Thoreau that I think I could recite from heart. They're just so beautiful and powerful. If you don't know anything about Thoreau, he was alive in the United States in New England, in Massachusetts, before the Civil War. And he was from a fairly upper middle class family. His father owned a pencil business. And in New England at this time, this was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And believe it or not, there's a lot of money to be made in the pencil business. And his father did really well. And as it turns out, if Thoreau had gone ahead and taken over the Thoreau Pencil Company, he would have been a rich man. And he went to school. At that time, there was only really one university in New England, that part of New England, that was Harvard. So he went to Harvard, he got a degree, He came back, and I was just doing some research on Thoreau, and it turns out Thoreau, his father's pencils were pretty good, but the lead wasn't really the best. So Thoreau came up with this way of combining graphite with clay, and it was a new procedure that it was being done in Germany too, but Thoreau figured it out, and I wrote an article in like an engineering journal on it, right? And so Thoreau had sort of this bright future ahead of him, and he didn't take advantage of it. You know, he decided that basically the way people were living was not a healthy way of life. And in his book, he talks about how unhealthy the way of life of people in his time was. You know, this part of New England was mostly still agricultural. And he says, you know, all of these farmers in my town, you know, they all inherit these big farms, and they fight to inherit them, and they're jealous of each other's farms. He said, to make them work, they all have to go deeply into debt. And he said, all their lives, they're struggling with these debts, right? And a lot of the time when they die, you know, loaded with debt. And he says, you know, even the wealthiest of them are under this terrific pressure all the time. And of course, this was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, so all these people were pouring into places in Massachusetts where they were building the first factories, and they were working like 16 hours a day, every day. So Thoreau had this idea that he was going to go, he said, you know, basically he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know what he was doing, but he had this idea that he was going to go out and live next to this pond, Walden Pond. Walden is the title of his famous book. And he bought all this scrap lumber for nothing, really. He just went around, he said, you know, instead of trying to get more and more, I'm going to try to live with less and less. And he built this little house on some rented land next to this pond. And he had a garden, right? And he grew a lot of the food he needed. He, by the way, he was a vegetarian. And he grew his own food. He was a vegetarian. He built his own house, and he lived there for 5 years. And it was for him. It was like this deeply transformative experience. And it, you know, he did go into town sometime. He would go into the local town and have dinner with his mom. You know, he might wash some laundry while he was over there, because, you know, so he wasn't trying to live, you know, a completely zero civilization life. But he wanted to be free. He said, I want to be free, and, you know, I want to have time to absorb, right? To just be present with things and not be so desirous of using them in some way that would be profitable, but simply to be with them. So, you know, in Walden, he writes about getting up early in the morning and just sitting, getting up early in the morning and sitting on his porch and just looking at the pond. And by the way, Thoreau had read he actually read French translations of Confucius and translated from the French some of Confucius's writings. He also had read some of the Vedas. He had read some and had done some translation himself. He knew a little Sanskrit, and he knew a little bit about Buddhism. And, you know, basically he bought into the idea that you could transform your consciousness, which he had picked up from all these different places that he was reading. So he would go out and he would sit and he would just, we would say he would meditate on the pond. And he would write about his daily life. You know, he'd say, this morning I heard a songbird, you know, it was singing for an hour. And you know, just sitting with the sound of the songbird will remind him of other things, of music, or how little we pause to listen to things like that. And anyway, when I love this book, it was a big inspiration for me. And when I was a kid, I read it and I decided to become like a backpacker. And when I first taught this course, I brought Thoreau in, and I assigned Thoreau, and I had no idea how little my students would understand of Thoreau. It was like they're totally, totally thrown. First of all, his style is very 19th century style, so it's very flowery. It's littered with references to history and to Greek mythology, and he'll quote Latin, you know, so it's very off-putting if you don't know the classical language, you know, for somebody who's not used to this. And my students had a hard time just understanding what he was talking about, but they also just had a hard time understanding why anybody would do this, right? You know, Rutgers students, I love Rutgers students. One of the things that is so endearing about them is that they're very straight, you know, they're not pretentious, and their hearts are in the right place. You know, most of them are really coming to college looking for a good job. And, you know, I assigned this thing about this guy who went out and lived in the woods in a shack for 5 years. That it was just baffling to them. And, you know, this was Thoreau's problem too, right? You know, Thoreau was writing at a time when everybody, almost everybody, thought he was a nut, really. They hadn't read the Vedas. You know, they hadn't read Confucius. They hadn't read the Bhagavad Gita, right? They were all trying to get a job, just like my students, right? Everybody wanted to get in on the action. And Thoreau was saying, basically, don't do it. You know, life could be better. And, you know, Thoreau was, my students just didn't get it. And so this time I did something totally different. We read this wonderful book, which you may have heard of, called Wild by Cheryl Strayed. And if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. But it really broke the ice with my students. Because, you know, basically, Cheryl Strayed is somebody who basically had to work really hard, came from a, you would say, working class background. She had to go to college on a scholarship, and still she had to work very hard. She, you know, she's from the kind of family where people have two jobs, right? Her stepfather was a carpenter. And her mother worked as a waitress and, you know, cleaning lady. And, you know, getting to college was really hard for her, right? In fact, you know, her mother had gotten pregnant when she was 19, so her mother didn't get to college. And Cheryl Strayed, you know, finally gets a scholarship to St. Paul University in Minneapolis. And her mother actually did too. Her mother, and they both went back to college together at the same time, you know? And actually then her mother got cancer and her mother died while she was in her senior year of college. And, you know, she, in the story, she develops, like, ways of coping with all of this that are not healthy. So one of the things she does is she uses a lot of drugs, right? She uses a lot of drugs, and she actually even tries heroin at one point, because one of her boyfriends gets her into heroin. She becomes like she's a super promiscuous person, right? So, you know, one of the ways she deals with her sadness or her anxiety is to just sleep with people, with men. And you know, I was so surprised to see my students react, you know, I was happy to see my students' reaction to this book, because I think they really understood her. Right? They really understood her. And you know, she is falling apart. She's in a destructive relationship with this guy who gets her into heroin. Her marriage falls apart because she's unfaithful to her husband. She can't be faithful to her husband after her mother's dead. And you know, she's sort of at a dead end, and she reads this book about hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail. And she decides to hike the Pacific Crest Trail, even though she's never done it. And of course, it's nothing like, you know, she buys a backpack, she works as a waitress, she buys as a backpack, she does all the planning, she sends food to friends along the trail or to post offices along the trail. She plans, you know, I'll hike 100 miles and I'll pick up a box with the food I'll need for the next 100 miles. She plans it all out. But it's unbelievably challenging for her. And, you know, basically, the second day she wants to quit. But, you know, the thing is, I think this worked so well with my students because I think she made I think they identified with her unhappiness. I think they could identify with her unhappiness. And that really broke the ice, you know. When I asked my students, I went around the class and I said, how many of you have actually hiked? I have a class of 20 students. Nobody has ever hiked in my class. Nobody, I said, how many of you, you know, go to a park or, you know, a green place? Nobody, you know, sometimes people go for a walk in their town park. But you know, so talking about the beauties of Walden Pond just didn't work for them. But talking about their suffering, actually, you know, that book really spoke to them. We work very, very hard to, we are very, very good at closing our world down and making it manageable, right? We're very good at that. My students are very good at that too. You know, they're under all these stresses. I think every one of my students has a job, like a second job. So, you know, I have students sometimes who come into my classroom and they're so tired. I can see that. I had a student last semester who actually fell asleep in class, and she was so ashamed, and she came up to see me and she said, you know, I have this job, you know, I have a job. As soon as I get out of your class, I have to go to the job, my other job.
Right.
So, you know, these students, just to sort of survive, I think they have to learn how to manage their mental life so that their anxieties and their sadness and their stresses and challenges are out of view, you know, out of view. And I think they learn to create like a little circle of controllability and calm, and you know, we're coping, like a circle where you can cope. And if they can do that well, they'll actually probably get through college, right? You know. And so this idea of like, you know, if you're afraid of your, you know, if you have, you're going to get out of college and you're going to have a $30,000 college debt, you know, you don't want to think about that while you're in college, or it will affect your performance, you know, affect your ability to function. So you just push that off. And, you know, if your parents are going through a divorce while you're in the middle of your freshman year, you know, you just push that off. You know, and, you know, I think everybody does this. You know, they learn how to push those things off and create like a manageable space, right? Manageable space. And, you know, because you can create that manageable space, you get up in the morning, and you're reasonably calm, you study for your test, you know, and you function, right? And I think this is how people live. You know, I think this is mostly how people live. They create like this circle of calm and manageability, and they keep all those things that are a little scary or a little challenging out of view. And, you know, they just get up and they just, you do what they have to do that day. And, you know, my students, I think, identified with Cheryl because she, for a long time, she was really good at that, right? But then, you know, little by little, she couldn't manage to protect that circle, and her world starts to fall apart. And then she has to do this crazy, desperate thing, going on this 1,000-mile hike. So we read that book we read that book first this time. I taught this course the second time, but we read Cheryl Strayed first. And you know, when she talks about going on the trail, this Pacific Crest Trail, she talks about these experiences where she gets to a place where she literally feels she can't go on. And then she says, you know, I felt like I couldn't go on. And then she said, suddenly I looked around me and I felt so alive and so connected. And she picks her backpack up and goes on. And she has like these moments again and again on the trail where she reaches the limits of her abilities to function. And it's like she flips into this other consciousness. And it feels wonderful. She feels connected. And she actually says at one point, she's reaching this place where she can't go on. And then suddenly she has that kind of an experience. It's like a breakthrough. And she sees a deer, and the deer looks at her, and she feels like the deer is saying, "You are safe in this world." So, you know, Cheryl Strayed was so good, I think, at teaching my students what Thoreau didn't manage to teach them the first time I taught Thoreau. You know, I think Thoreau is just a little too distant from their world. But, you know, Cheryl spoke really directly to their fears and their sense of helplessness and their anxieties, and you know, they trusted her because she did that, right? And Thoreau doesn't really do that. You know, he always plays this all-knowing role. They trusted her because she'd been there or was there, and they sort of went on this journey with her. And it was, I think you know, all of them are writing about it. They all of them have been deeply moved by it. You know. So what does this have to do with the koan? What does this have to do with Zen? You know, I think a life skill for everyone is creating this sort of zone of functionality, right? And we repress a lot of our fears and our sadness. We push it out of view, and we we could function. When I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, before I met my wife, I met this really interesting woman who was working at the restaurant where I was a cook. I was the cook, and she was a music major at the University of New Mexico. And she was telling me about having two parents who both died within a couple years of one another. From emphysema. Both of her parents were died from emphysema. And she was talking about caring for two people, you know, while she's in high school. And you know, at one point I said, "How did you get through it?" And one of the things she said was, you know, "I just would make lists, you know." So I'd make a little list, and, you know, today I would just tick off the items on the list. And you know, she created like this zone of, you know, functionality, right? And people create that, and I think because they create it, they're able to go on with their lives. But you can see, you know, how limiting that is, you know. You get good at making your world whole, W-H-O-L-E, by making your world small. You get good at making the world a functional reality for you, but you do that like at this great price, right, of leaving out a lot of things in life, maybe almost everything. You know, you become like, it's like living in tunnel vision, and I think to some extent we all live in tunnel vision. And I think what finally breaks Cheryl Strayed out of her tunnel vision, you know, is her mother's death. Her father abandoned her mother and her mother's three kids, you know. Her mother had a series of boy. She never saw her father again. Her mother had a series of boyfriends who were not great partners, and when she finally found somebody who was sort of a surrogate father to Cheryl, you know, as soon as Cheryl's mother died, that guy left. He just abandoned that family. So they've been abandoned multiple. You know, she was able to function for a long time, but finally, you know, something was, she was unable to cope with something, and she had to sort of like bust out of her little circle. So I think her dilemma is really our dilemma. You know, I really think that this is what we all do, and we all cope, and we all manage by keeping out of view some of the sources of our sadness and fear. And, you know, I think people start, they get interested in Buddhism because that project of like managing that circle, protecting that barrier or that boundary, becomes really labor intensive, and it doesn't always work. You know, things start to get through. I was reading just yesterday in the paper that I'm very interested in people, my students and their world. And this paper by a couple of therapists was saying that like half the students in college now have difficulty coping. You know, a lot of them register periods of depression and, you know, anxiety, panic attacks. And you know, I think they're in a situation where, you know, that management project is getting harder and harder for them. I think, in a way, that's a wonderful place to be, believe it or not. I certainly don't want to see people suffer. But, you know, I think to myself, you know, my students are, I think, unhappy about the way the world is. And a lot of them get down or even struggle with depression and anxiety and so on. But you know, I actually think I would worry more if they didn't. Right? I mean, I hope you'll take this the right way, but when I look around at the world, I actually am a little bit happy that my students are uncomfortable with it, you know. And if they were all comfortable with it, you know, that would worry me more, you know, because my feeling is that the hope for the world is that it could be better than it is right now, it could be different. And that will mean that students, people like my students, will not necessarily continue just to cope, but they'll try to break out of that, they'll try to expand that circle, you know. And I think that's the hope for the future, right? Is if students, these students who are struggling with, you know, I think rational unhappiness about the world, if they're willing to face their unhappiness a little bit, and that's a real challenge, right? Because if you're just coping, if you're just making lists, right? It's like the last thing I need is this, right? Last thing I need to deal with is this. So we're like protecting those boundaries, those borders. when people start doing Zen, I often think, or Buddhism or meditation, I often think it's because things are getting through those borders and making them, they're shaking their confidence in their ability to maintain their space of functionality. And, you know, meditation really helps. I mean, I when I started meditating, like, in 2027, I will be, have been practicing, in fact, I've been practicing for 50 years, meditation for 50 years. When I started doing meditation, I definitely struggled with depression. I struggled with, you know, feelings of, with anxiety, you know, definitely anxiety. And when I started doing meditation, it really helped, really helped. So I would come to the Zen Center, the Seattle Zen Center, and I would meditate. And at the end of a session, my stress level was so much lower. It was like I could breathe. And I'd go in there very wound up, and I'd come out happy, you know, happy. And, you know, that when that stress wasn't sort of right there all the time, taking my breath away, I began, my depression began to dissipate, right? I began to be less depressed. And you know, for a while, I just felt like this was the most fantastic thing in the world. You know, but actually, you know, if people practice just to get to that place, it doesn't really make their world bigger, right? One way to practice Zen is to practice just to keep that space intact, right? And I think lots of people do practice various practices, Vedanta, Zen, you know, whatever, just sort of like maintain that, keep that list going and keep those boundaries intact. A more kind of mature practice is like slowly letting some of that stuff in, slowly, not in an overwhelming way, but once you can draw a circle on the ground and sit in the center of that circle on your meditation mat, and you can feel grounded and safe, right? That's a wonderful day, and we're also lucky that is possible. And once we can do that, we're on our way, but we're not, the journey's beginning, it's not over, right? I mean, what we have to start doing then is letting some things that are troubling come through the gate, letting them come through the door. And that's frightening and can be painful too, right? But that's how we keep expanding that circle. That's how we keep expanding. You know, so in our particular school of meditation, Zen, we use what are called koans. It's Rinzai Zen, but we use what are called koans. And, you know, when a teacher gives you a koan, you know, you go into deep samadhi, you sit on that cushion in the middle of that beautiful circle, and you enter samadhi, and your head points to the heavens, and your spine goes down into the earth, and you watch your breath, and you're serene, and then you start working with a koan, right? And the koan is something, right? If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And, you know, as you start working with this koan, you know, you might find something arises that's, you know, you suddenly realize, you know, you're really kind of unhappy, you know. And you might think, you know, my Zen training really isn't working out. You know, now I'm unhappy again. And I thought this meditation practice was supposed to end my suffering. Right? Isn't that? Buddhism is about suffering and an end to suffering. But actually, you know, an end to suffering is more complicated than just sitting on a cushion and entering samadhi. You know, when you're working with a koan, you may suddenly find yourself confronting emotions or experiences that you've buried somewhere long ago, you know, and now they're back, and you know, you have to deal with that. And basically, when you have to deal with these things, you know, you're equipped now for them in a way that maybe you weren't before. Because, you know, before, you know, when you're just making lists and you're trying to cope and you're trying to, you have your job and you have your school and, you know, it's all you can do to just get another gulp of air. Not much can be done, but, you know, once you can get to that grounded, centered place, which is so precious and so beautiful, and you start taking on your obstacles, your sadnesses, your fears, your disappointments, one by one, you know, you're in this grounded place, so it, you know, it's not going to overwhelm you, right? It's not going to overwhelm you. It's just like, you know, little by little, we open this door and let this in, and then we open this door and let this in, and we open this. And each time we open the door, you know, it might feel frightening or threatening. But, you know, now we know how to, you know, sit with our sadness, you know, sit with our sadness, sit with our sense of loss. And, you know, we think that, you know, like losing a parent, you know, that's, as many of you know, 20 years ago, I lost my brother. You know, my brother got cancer, and he died when he was 50 years old. And he actually died just before a sesshin, you know. So I didn't cancel the sesshin. I came to the sesshin, and my koan for the sesshin was my brother's death. And, you know, I have been practicing Zen for a long time, so I had a lot of confidence in my ability to deal with things like this. I had a lot of trust in my big mind, is what we would say in Zen. And, you know, it was challenging, of course. You know, every day I would get up and go into samadhi, and there was my brother's death, you know. And, you know, every day that would hurt, you know, it really hurts. I mean, I would go back and cry in my room. You know, I would think about my brother and I when we were little kids and so on. You know, and, you know, at the end of the sesshin, you know, my brother, whom I love very much, died. And at some point, you know, all that grief just went away. And nothing can replace my brother, but it was like a sky full of dark clouds clearing, and then just a clear blue sky. And, you know, I loved my brother. I'm glad he was in my life. I'm glad he had the opportunity to be alive, and I had the opportunity to know him. And there are no clouds in the sky. And that's what we call in Zen working through your obstacle. Things happen to you, and, you know, they cause all this suffering and all this fear, and then, you know, you work through all that, and they just happen to you. Things just happen to you. And then your mind is like a blue sky. And this is the process of Zen, right? It's like, every time you do this, every time you go through this process, your world, the perfect circle of your samadhi gets larger and larger. And, you know, instead of just trying to maintain a little tunnel of functionality, it becomes larger and larger and larger and larger. If we practice just to be calm, or if we practice just to be happy, and there's nothing wrong with being calm and happy, you know, we miss the chance to go farther than that, you know, and every time we work through an obstacle, we become, it's like becoming more porous or more open. and actually more trusting. So you know, at first it's very difficult to trust this process. You know, it really is. When I went to the Seattle Zen Center, it helped me pretty much right away. But then I was frozen in my practice for about 3 years, right? My first teacher, Takabayashi Genki Roshi, gave me a koan. He said, "I want you to watch your breath and just be one with your breath." And I couldn't be one with my breath, right? I couldn't trust my breath. So every time I would come in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan, I would try to demonstrate to him how aware I was, or perceptive I was, or I wrote poems. You know, I did things like I brought in flowers, you know, I tried to be creative. And all of that's like not trusting. You know, I committed myself to Zen because I, you know, partly as like compensation for not being good at other things. I thought, well, maybe I could be a great Zen master. You know, I might not be a great English professor, I might not be, you know, but maybe I could be a great Zen master. And, you know, the longer I failed to answer my koan, the more worried I got about my plan to be a great Zen master. Right? So you know, I was going to graduate school, but my fallback was, if I can't be a distinguished literary critic, maybe I can be a great Zen master. But my fallback was falling apart, right? My fallback wasn't working out. Because all the other people in the group were passing their koans like crazy, and I couldn't even get through the first koan. And I was trying my darndest. You know, I would come in and, you know, sing, I would do. I just couldn't let myself trust the process. Because I thought, you know, I don't think consciously I didn't, but I just unconsciously, I was so untrusting. Right? I was so worried of failing that I was failing. So worried about failing. So, you know, only years later did I really understand my breath. You know, did I really realize that the breath is the most amazing thing? You know, anatomically, the breath goes out your nose, it goes in your nose and out your nose. The O2 goes in the CO2. That has nothing to do with the way we experience our breath. You know, if you watch the breath, you know, your sense of physicality can disappear. The interior and exterior disappear. There's just breath, right? You know, you might feel like the breath is coming out of your forehead or something like that. That's how we experience the breath when we don't have a biased mind. You know, we think we understand the breath. I thought I understood the breath. Why don't you give me a real... I thought, why doesn't Genki give me a real koan? Why is he treating me like I'm an idiot, right? But I never understood, you know, the breath is none of the things we think it is. You know, to watch the breath is to go on this amazing journey, right? But it's so hard to trust the process. If you just watch the breath and say, I don't know what the breath is, let's see what's going to happen. You know, it comes out your forehead, it disappears, you disappear, your hands disappear, your face disappears. All of these things happen. You feel like you're disembodied, you feel like you're a spider web, you feel like all of these things happen when you watch the breath. I didn't report any of these to my teacher because I didn't trust the process. You know, and so I was agonized and miserable for the longest time. And that was painful and difficult. But on the other side of that, you know, finally I met my breath. You know, how amazing. You know, when you watch your breath, your mind goes blank. Everything disappears. All these things happen. So, you know, this is a koan about it's essential to be able to get to that place where you are calm and grounded. Samadhi. Right? You watch the breath, You get to this place where you're calm and grounded. Everything is one. Everything is one. You see, that one leaves out all kinds of things. That's not really one. Right? It feels like oneness, but it's not. By the way, this was Thoreau's problem. You know, he kept trying to tell people, your way of life is really fucked up, right? And he, you know, when Thoreau was writing, slavery was normal. You know, millions of people were enslaved and nobody thought it was a bad thing, really. Most Americans thought, well, yeah, they have slavery in the South. Yeah, it's too bad, right? That was it, you know? It was so hard to convince people that that was a terrible crime. People thought it was normal. They had drawn a little circle. You know, they were living in their little circle, right? Yeah, yeah, they have slavery. I'm glad we don't have slavery up here, you know. So Thoreau was an abolitionist, right? You know, Thoreau said to his fellow New Englanders, you know, you don't think you look at the South and you say, thank God we don't have slavery. But he said, most of you live like slaves. You know, you work in the factory 16 hours a day. You work on your farm from dawn to dusk and you never get out of debt. It's so hard. He tried so hard to make people realize that the little circle they were living in was a self-protective cocoon that kept them from seeing the world as it really is. And when I tried it out on my students, they didn't get it either, but, you know, Cheryl Strayed made a lot of sense to them. Because, you know what, she pointed very directly to their suffering. You know, Thoreau starts out and says, I'm on this beautiful lake, your life could be like this, if you just came out to Walden Pond, you would be sitting with the gods, right? But Cheryl Strayed said, you know, man, you know, when I'm stressed, the only thing that'll do is to go out and go to a bar and have some guy take me home, right? And that works for a little while. Or, you know, doing some coke, right? And, you know, fortunately, I don't think my students do drugs. I hope they don't. But they have these sources of suffering that you pointed to directly and actually so effective, you know? And you know, that gives me so much hope. You know, there are lots of reasons that students shouldn't be well-adjusted, actually, in our world, I think. I think that the fact that they're anxious and maybe unhappy with the world is a sign of their mental health, not their mental ill health, although they probably have health challenges, too. And the hope is that, you know, they will not get trapped in creating those little circles of functionality. In protecting themselves from their suffering, don't, you know, let's hope they don't close their world down too much. And we in Zen, our job is to, you know, confront all the time, you know, find the circle of oneness, right? And then start opening that door to the things that we're afraid of or that we're anxious about. You know, we have a million of them, right? And every time we let one of those in, you know, it's like you lose that unity for a while. It's like you lose the unity, but then it comes back and it's bigger. And then you lose the unity and it comes back and it's bigger. And you lose the unity, but it comes back and it's bigger. It's like every one of your Buddhas is destroyed, right? You know, the first time you're in samadhi, you think, this is it, I've got it. But, you know, meanwhile, you have a temper that explodes unpredictably. Where's that coming from? So one day you're sitting on the cushion and you realize, I am so angry about something. And now your equanimity is gone, your calm is gone, your clay Buddha has melted in the torrent of events. And then, you know, you work it out. You get back to that calm place and then, you know, something else happens, right? And you realize, oh my God, you know, my brother is dying of cancer. That's so unfair. You know, he didn't deserve that. He was 50 years old. His kids were teenagers. You know, and my Buddha was melted in the fire. But that's just, that's not the Buddha. That's just my image of the Buddha. And then, you know, each of your Buddhas is destroyed, but, you know, the real Buddha, you get closer and closer to the real Buddha. That circle of oneness just gets bigger and bigger if you let in what you're afraid to let in. That's the secret. But just one at a time. You don't have to do it all at once. Just one at a time. Main subject. Joshu said, clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. Secho's verse. Clay Buddhas cannot pass through water. But the divine light illuminates heaven and earth. Had Shinko, this Shinko is the first Chinese ancestor who met Bodhidharma, who sat in the snow and cut off his arm so Bodhidharma would let him in. Had Shinko not stood in the snow, if he hadn't paid, been willing to deal with his stuff, his fears and his anxieties, he had to cut off his arm. He would have lived a life of deception and self-deception and pretense. Metal Buddhas cannot pass through a furnace. Men came to Shiko, another Zen master, and found the warning notice on the board, but everywhere, gentle breezes. See, every time we work through our obstacles, what follows are the gentle breezes, the blue sky without a cloud. Wooden Buddhas cannot pass through fire. I always remember how monk Hasoda broke down the oven of sacrifice whose god so long had bound him. So, another barrier broken.